It'll be about drugs. It'll be about alcohol. Some of it will be very violent in nature. And most of it is full of profanities, of swear words, which, as Muslims, we know is problematic to use and also to listen to. So at one level is the lyrics. This is a problem, brothers and sisters. And don't say, oh, you know, I'm impervious. They're talking about drugs. I don't do drugs. They're talking about alcohol. I don't drink. They're talking about, you know, relationships with the opposite gender. I keep away from that, but I just like the music. These lyrics have an impact on our soul. And if that was not the fact, you know, much of the music that has a lot of vulgarity, a lot of negative content, they wouldn't have parental guidance labels on them that, you know, over 16 or over 18 can't, you know, buy that. Because they realize that when we're young, especially, that this music can make an impression on our mind because we're much more impressionable at those young ages. So the lyrics we have to be very, very aware of. But what about the music itself, the actual tone, the content of what is being played? Scholars of the sciences, not Muslim scholars, but scholars in terms of sociology, of psychology, they've actually done a lot of research on the effect of music on the human mind and the dopamine levels, these levels of the brain's reaction to when it hears things. And they've actually come up with studies and research, even some research that was done in McGill University in Montreal in Canada, which went to show how the effect of music on the human mind is similar to that of taking drugs. So some of the same levels of ecstasy, of joy, of euphoria that people feel when they smoke marijuana or where they inject a drug, some of the research points to the fact that listening to music triggers those same hormones within the brain. It does something to the mind. And look online, there is much research done even about why they play certain music in the stores. Why is it, let's say, at a certain time of the year, a certain music is playing in the store? And they've shown how, through research, how they are able to control the spending habits of people when they come shopping, depending on the music that the store is playing. They've shown, they've done tests that when they play a certain music in a certain store, people stay longer. They graze around, they walk through every aisle, and they spend more money. So don't think that the music industry is all innocent and it's just there to provide us with relaxation and enjoyment after a hard day at work or at school. No, it is they know very well what they're doing, right? The billions of dollars they spend in the music industry.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. محمد يا مؤمني صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio. Mm-hmm.
7. Barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, name that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, your host, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the things that we as human beings should strive for is the search for truth, is the search for reality. For between truth and reality, there is no difference. Reality is truth and truth is reality. But in order for us to see that, there is effort that is required, that at times we need to remove the dust from our eyes, the shades from our eyes, in order to see the reality. Those shades being, for example, the way we were brought up. Certain things that we see as fact, when in fact they are not fact. They are just fiction. Or certain things that have been built up in us that we need to kind of break down. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a journey of a person towards the truth which he felt that he found. A journey of a person who was brought up in one way, having to break down all of that which he had learned in order to accept another path that he saw as being the truth. This is something important, and it's something that is extremely difficult to do. And alhamdulillah, this person was able to do so. And in this book, he tells his story, that this is how I was guided. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be mentioning the book and the author. So please stay tuned.
حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن إن في الجنة نهرا إن بان
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we would like to introduce is titled Then I Was Guided. It is a very famous book. I'm sure many of our listeners have heard this title. It was written by a scholar, Muhammad Al-Tijani Al-Samawi, or Al-Samawi. And he is of Tunisian descent. What is something very peculiar to me is that I've read this book many times, and I've never ever found the translator of this book. Nowhere is it written, even though I searched for it before this program, and I could not find it. Maybe the person wished to remain anonymous. Allahu alam. But the translator of this book is not known exactly who it is. Nor in the book is it mentioned. So anyway, Sheikh Tijani mentions the reason for this book. And he said that this is, or rather, the description of this book, and then there is a dedication. So the description is, this is an autobiographical account of Sayyid Tijani's search for knowledge, which aims to remove some of the barriers that exist between the schools of thought of the Ahl al-Sunnah and the Shia by clearing misconceptions about Shiism. So now we understand that Sheikh Tijani was a Sunni. He then became Shia, and this is the journey that he took and the reasons why he chose that particular path. And he has a dedication. And this, in fact, is the method by which this book should be read. It is very important that this is followed. He writes, dedication. My book is a modest piece of work. It is a story of a journey, a story of a new discovery, not a technical or natural discovery, one in the field of religious and philosophical schools. Since any discovery is based primarily on a healthy mind and clear comprehension, which distinguishes human beings from all other creatures, I would like to dedicate this book to every healthy mind A mind which puts truth to the test and knows it from wrong. A mind which weighs all that has been said in the scale of justice and always comes out in favor of reason. A mind which compares words and sayings and has the ability to distinguish between the logical and the not so logical, and between the strong and the feeble. Allah, the Most High, has said, those who listen to the saying and follow the best of it, those are guided by, and they are the mindful. To all those I dedicate this book, hoping that Allah, praise be to Him, the Most High, opens our minds before our eyes to guide us, to enlighten our hearts, to show us clearly the right way so we follow it, and to show us clearly the wrong so we avoid it, and accepts us with His good servants, for He listens and He answers. Muhammad Al-Tijani Al-Samawi. So please stay tuned for a small section from within the contents of this book in our next segment.
وصلني على الهادي حبيبي جد الحسن رسولي معدن الجود إمام الحرام نبينا خير من يمشي على قدمي يا عاشق صلوا على سيد الكون سيد الكون
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we are discussing is titled Then I Was Guided, written by Muhammad Al-Tijani Al-Samawi. His journey from becoming Sunni to Shi'i. I have met the author on many occasions. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala protect him. So one of the important things about this book, and is a lesson for all of us, is the initial start of the research of Sheikh Tijani. What caused him to partake in the research of finding the truth? That's just an important lesson for all of us. It was a meeting that Sheikh Tijani had with an Iraqi scholar on a boat that they were taking. They were journeying on a boat together and they were going somewhere, I can't remember exactly where. The actions and behavior of this particular Iraqi scholar motivated Sheikh Tijani to go and find the truth. So we see the effects of our behaviors on others is extremely important. So we quote here from the meeting between Sheikh Tijani and this Iraqi scholar. So they had a conversation. So this is before, obviously, they arrived in Iraq for the boat journey and so on. So the Iraqi teacher then smiled. So there was this conversation, and Iraqi teacher told him he was Shia. Then Sheikh Tijani got very upset and angry. Why are you telling me this? If you knew you were Shia, I would not have spoken to you. So on this, the Iraqi teacher then smiled and told me that he was a Shia. I was a little disturbed by his answer and thoughtlessly said, if I knew you were Shia, I would not have spoken to you. He asked, why? I replied, because you are not Muslims. You worship Ali ibn Abi Talib. And the moderates among you worship Allah, but do not believe in the message of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. You curse the archangel Gabriel for betraying what he was entrusted with. Instead of delivering the message to Ali, he gave it to Muhammad. I continued with this type of anecdote while my companion listened carefully, at times smiling and at times showing his astonishment. When I finished talking, he asked me again, are you a teacher teaching students? I answered, yes. He said, if that is what the teachers think, then we cannot blame the ordinary people who barely have any education. I said, what do you mean? He answered, I beg your pardon, but from where did you get all of these false allegations? I told him that my information came from famous history books, and the rest is common knowledge. Then he said, well, let us leave the people. But could you tell me what books have you read? I started mentioning a few books, such as those by Ahmed Amin, Fajr al-Islam, Duha al-Islam, and Zuhur al-Islam, and many others. And then obviously the conversation continued until the story goes on. And I really, you know, recommend our dear listeners just to read the introduction to this book, even if you don't actually read the actual contents. The introduction is something worth reading. Inshallah, until our next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran has ascended from observer state to full member of the UN Scientific Committee on Effects of Atomic Radiation, UNSCEAR. That committee, which was set up in 1955, is tasked with providing information on occupational, medical, natural radiation and the associated health risks. The importance of the work is testament enough to Iran's nuclear capability for civilian use. It's a capability Iran acquired in spite of sabotage and sanction at almost every critical turning point. This country is among the top eight in that it can produce a full nuclear fuel cycle without foreign help. The usual suspects, America and Israel, aren't pleased, but Iran has weathered it all. And now it has indigenous facilities and abilities, nuclear facilities and abilities, which I will bring to you in this episode. So stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Iran can complete the nuclear fuel cycle from the stage of exploration, extraction, conversion, enrichment, fuel production to waste management, as well as mastering various types of lasers and quantum technology. We got to talk to Dean of the Nuclear Faculty at Shahid Beheshti University. That would be Mr. Aghamiri, PhD.
Taking a closer look at the world, you'll realize that countries aren't usually involved in all the aspects of nuclear technology. France, for example, is solely focused on enrichment, Namibia on mining, another nation on fuel production, and so on. That is, the work is shared amongst them. There have been only three countries that have done the whole process by themselves, namely the United States, China, and Russia in the days of the former Soviet Union. Now that Iran wants to start work on peaceful nuclear energy and have reactors, it should have access or free access to any of those matters. That's why it attempted to complete the fuel cycle by itself.
Never mind this country's nuclear program in general. Even Iran's full membership to UNSCEAR faced stiff opposition from Israel and the US. That doesn't fit with their show of suspicion towards Iran's nuclear program, though, because full membership will mean this country's participation in peaceful nuclear activity and services on the international scene, rather than on just the national scale. Iran will be an extra pair of hands among four recent additions, bringing the UNSCAR list up to 31 full member states. Mr. Beheshtipour is a nuclear affairs specialist who served as Correspondence Bureau Chief here at Press TV. He joined us on Skype.
Iran has always wanted to become a member of the committee and has had the qualifications too. Also, it may be exposed to radiation because of Israel's adventures. We are not exposed at the moment, but there is always the potential danger. Therefore, Iran's cooperation on the matter can both help develop Iran's scientific knowledge and also result in international cooperation to prevent nuclear radiation anywhere in the world. The U.S. and Israel have had no valid argument for their opposition to Iran's membership in the committee. This, unfortunately, has been in line with their opposition to the advancement of science.
Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Takht-e Ravanchi, made a comment on the significance of the committee and valuable contribution Iran would make to it. This country would help expand knowledge and understanding of levels, effects, and risks of exposure to ionizing radiation. It could help in the training of personnel and protecting public and environmental health against harmful effects of atomic radiation. Iran has been invited to introduce a nuclear scientist to participate in the UNSCAR meetings.
There are three natural radiation zones in Iran where uranium is located near the surface of the ground and radon gas has the highest concentration compared to anywhere else in the world. In some areas where there are hot springs, there's a high concentration of radon gas too. We announced in 1990 that we have the necessary standards for radon gas. The work kicked off and the IAEA held a conference in the northern city of Ramsar. We expected them to start their work sooner because of Iran's capabilities, so we could become a member of the standard-setting board that determines the scales, units, and other technical nuclear matters. Fortunately, this has been done now, which is a positive development.
Nowadays, and with the rapid increase in use of nuclear technology for peaceful purposes in many areas, including power production, health, agriculture, biotechnology, pharmacology, and industry, the committee's role is becoming increasingly imperative, Takht-e Ravanchi said. Some say, what good is a nuclear program to Iran when it has only meant sanctions and further economic hardship? I'm pretty sure our nuclear scientist has a confident answer to that, though.
Some people would ask, why go after nuclear energy when we already have oil and gas? But if the argument was true, the Shah also had oil and gas, but why did the West provide him with nuclear energy? Rest assured that nuclear energy, if done right, is one of the cleanest and most economical energies. The United Arab Emirates is one of the world's biggest producers of oil and gas, but it already has built a reactor and has signed a contract with South Korea for three more. So has Saudi Arabia.
Iran unveiled 133 new nuclear achievements to mark its 15th anniversary of the National Nuclear Technology Day, 9th April. It injected uranium hexafluoride gas into a pilot cascade of 164 new generation IR-6 centrifuges at the Natanz enrichment facility. Mechanical testing of IR-9 centrifuges also began as this country launched an assembly line for their production. IR-6 centrifuges are known to be 10 times more efficient than the previous cascade, while the IR-9 centrifuge is 50 to 60 times more efficient.
Uranium enrichment requires the most complicated technologies to both prevent vibrations and increase the centrifuge's speed and power. Imagine something spinning at 60,000 rotations per minute. That's 1,000 rotations per second. The slightest vibration can result in an explosion and damage. The technology must work very accurately to be able to be used. Iran can ramp up its enrichment purity fast if and when it wills.
Whatever the purpose of Iran's program, Israel is not in a place to point fingers. If only folks knew their place. Israel, otherwise known as the Zionist regime, has not adhered to the rules and regulations prohibiting the production, development, and stockpiling of weapons of mass destruction and its arsenals. Also, Israel displays a threatening temperament towards world peace and security and regional stability, whereas Iran's nuclear projects and products speak for themselves. So please listen closely to hear of this country's nuclear program's humanitarian uses. Some other projects and products displayed at the Iranian exhibition, by the way, are as follows. 1. The second phase of industrial plants producing deuterated compounds in Khandab in Iraq. Those are for emergency care for burns using radiation therapy. And 2. A number of centrifuge machines used by the Blood Transfusion Organization of Iran. And 3. 110 isotope-based biomolecules used in neonatal screening kits. Also unveiled was a device for online metering of uranium hexafluoride purity and 4 new radiopharmaceuticals.
Iran's success in the field of making medicine and isotopes to treat cancer patients in the past few years has been remarkable. Iran has produced several radiopharmaceuticals. Iran has also continued its studies on making uranium metal. Iran wants to make uranium metal to improve the fuel at the Tehran reactor. The West's propaganda claims Iran is doing so to make a bomb, but uranium metal has different uses.
For a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
To sum it up, nuclear science doesn't have to mean an atom bomb of the kind America dumped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the 1940s, nor does it have to line up nuclear warheads of the kind Israel is known to have hundreds of. It has scientific humanitarian use Iran's upgraded UNSCEAR membership would enhance. Medically, it can be used for diagnosis by PET devices and for treatment by radiotherapy, radioisotope therapy, that's unstable and radioactive isotopes of an element, or even iodine therapy, a method for treating hyperthyroidism. Iranians are even making important laboratory tools such as cyclotron and radiomix.
Iran built a factory in 2003 to make heavy water for the Arak reactor. The factory is still active and produces heavy water under the supervision of the IAEA. One of the uses for heavy water is in nuclear reactors that work with natural uranium and don't need any enrichment. The Arak reactor, with a 40 megawatt capacity, will be making medicinal radioisotopes. It's currently still under construction. Tehran is still doing work to complete the project by itself.
Not easy to respectably criticize the scientific outcome of research on nuclear activity. But the path in getting there is spiked and freely criticized. The West criticizes Iran's production of uranium metal. But Ali Akbar Salehi, former AEOI head, said the Tehran research reactor uses old fuel, and we must look for a new fuel that is at the forefront of knowledge. We produced a sample of uranium silica alloy. Unfortunately, it was high purity, and we will use this fuel for the Tehran reactor in the future. Interestingly, Iran can design modern fuel itself instead of reverse engineering it. But where does it all happen? I have a list of some of Iran's nuclear facilities, some famous, others hardly heard of, which I will bring to you, but after a quick media review. And here's what our select media outlets have to say. Mehr News reads, global arrogance not tolerate Iran's scientific technological progress. Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, AEOI, said the enemies of the Islamic Republic do not want to see the scientific and technological achievements of the country in the international arena. He made the remarks on his visit to the exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry achievements, which was held at the Den of Espionage, that's the former U.S. embassy in Tehran, on Wednesday, November the 10th. During the visit, Eslami emphasized that development of advanced technologies, especially nuclear science and technology, is a need for the development and progress of the country, and noted that enemies of the country are leaving no stone unturned in order to stop Iran's scientific and technological progresses, so that Iran is equipped with talented scientists and researchers who are able to steer the country towards development and progress in international arenas. It should be noted that some of the most important achievements in Iran's nuclear industry were showcased in the exhibition in the fields of radiation application, nuclear agriculture, industrial and medical centrifuges, diagnostic and therapeutic, radiopharmaceuticals, medical laser prostate surgery, nuclear fuel cycle, heavy water production, and the likes. Tehran Times quotes an MP who says, new round of talks should ensure national interests. The deputy chairman of the Parliament's National Security and Foreign Policy Committee has stressed that the Vienna talks, which will start in late November with the purpose of lifting sanctions on Iran, should ensure the country's interests. If the negotiations serve our interests, we will pursue them seriously. And if the interests of the Iranian people are not served, there is no reason to pursue attritional negotiations, Abbas Mokhtadai said. The MP added, the simplicity of the negotiations is due to the fact that the Islamic Republic fully fulfilled its obligations based on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. But the Western parties, especially Americans, did not fulfill their obligations, which they had accepted, and they harmed Iran's interests by not adhering to their commitments. Tasnim News looks to brother nations. Iran ready for nuclear cooperation with Muslim nations, says spokesman. The spokesperson for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran expressed the country's readiness to work with Islamic countries in the promotion of nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. The AEOI spokesman Behrouz Kamalvandi expressed Iran's readiness to cooperate with Islamic countries in the promotion of nuclear technology for the Muslim nation's welfare. He said such cooperation would pave the way for the modern Islamic civilization, as working shoulder to shoulder will help the Islamic community to mark a bright future. He finally noted that Iran has made great advances in all fields and technologies related to the nuclear industry, saying the Iranian scientists are working in various arenas, including the discovery and extraction of uranium, production and enrichment of various nuclear fuels, construction of nuclear power plants, production of radio medicine, and application of nuclear technologies and laser in industries and agriculture. And that would be it for the news segment. Do stay tuned. Iran's nuclear facilities are namely the Bonab Atomic Energy Research Center, which conducts research on irradiation and other agricultural issues. There's Bushehr, which has two partially completed nuclear power reactors of 1,000 megawatts. As for Natanz, it is the famous uranium enrichment facility, which was also famously sabotaged of late. Last on my list is Isfahan Nuclear Fuel Research and Production Center. That's Iran's largest nuclear research center, where about 3,000 scientists work.
To keep the Natanz Center running, we need experts in electronics, computer science, chemistry, physics, physical chemistry, and many other sciences required to run the Natanz complex with computers. This will help advance knowledge and science in chemistry, physics, IT, electronics, and other fields.
To keep it all going and enhancing, education can never stop. But before getting to that, let's go over the many instances of sabotage Iran's nuclear program has weathered and why. Talks between Iran and the U.S. are not preluded by friendliness, at least on the U.S.'s part. A common coincidence is sabotage of Iran's nuclear program and killing of its nuclear scientists by U.S. ally Israel most every time Iran and the West are about to come to an understanding. Now, a seventh round of the critical JCPOA Vienna talks are scheduled for November the 29th. So just before, when Iran's been accepted as full member to the UNSCEAR, Israel's objection is a given.
The Westerners have attempted to block our progress on three occasions so far. The first was in 2003 when they asked us to suspend our work to negotiate. We had made considerable progress in a short period back then, but to prove our goodwill and let them verify that we're not after nuclear weapons and that our goal is peaceful, we agreed to the suspension. The suspensions were the first incident that hurt our nuclear program. The Westerners, not including the US at the time, tried to stop us, but 2 years later we started our work again. They realized that they couldn't stop us, and then came the assassinations.
The April round of Vienna talks came just 3 days after a sabotage attack at the key Iranian nuclear plant near Natanz, an act of nuclear terrorism, as Iran put it. What happened was an explosion cut off electricity to the site, damaging an unknown number of centrifuges. Centrifuges are machines that make uranium usable for nuclear purposes. Mr. Abniki is former head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization's Development Center. He shared his views with Iran Today.
It is needless to say that the sanctions have been in place since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, when the Iranians decided to be independent and not to be despicably submissive to the West anymore. Since that day, they have been imposing different sanctions under different pretexts. And if we didn't have nuclear program, they would definitely find another excuse to justify their mean sanctions. They want us to be entirely dependent, so that we become completely obedient to them. They could not tolerate our missile program too, because they know it has strengthened our authority and defensive power.
The Vienna talks are to get the U.S. to lift sanctions off this country, what it was supposed to do by the 2015 JCPOA or nuclear deal. But former U.S. President Donald Trump binned that deal and reimposed and reinforced sanctions on this country, so Iran also started reversing its commitments to the deal. Now, what's the result of that and U.S. efforts, continuous U.S. efforts to weaken Iran's nuclear program and portray its politicians as weak in the eyes of the people? Iran mustered up its will and is now enriching uranium to 60%. That's up from what was under 4% to 20% and now 60%. Iran also attempted adding about 1,000 advanced centrifuges to its operation at Natanz. Looks like the U.S. missed again. Its greatest achievement from all its plotting and planning has been to alienate the Iranian people. It's not just the level of purity that matters, but the volume. Iran's 20% enriched uranium reserves now exceed 210 kilograms, and its 60% reserves amount to 25 kilograms. This country is also producing 150 types of deuterons, radiopharmacies used for diagnosing and treating various diseases, including cancer, and the best heavy water in the world. Also, we've made considerable progress in producing laser applicable in healthcare as well as industrial sectors. The April 2021 Natanz attack was not the first. Last summer came a destruction of a large assembly facility for advanced centrifuges. More recently, there was an assassination against a very prominent Iranian nuclear scientist, Fakhrizadeh. That was 27th November 2020. Also, years ago, under the Obama administration, the cyber attack Stuxnet did significant damage to centrifuges at Natanz. It is in a game similar to the American game that Iran has moved up to 60% uranium enrichment to strengthen its negotiating position in the Vienna talks, among other reasons.
The Americans and the Israelis had a plan to damage Iranian facilities by any means, one of which was the Stuxnet virus. They had put the virus in the equipment installed in our facilities, enabling them to infiltrate some of the computers that run the centrifuges. Needless to say, all centrifuges are run by computers, so the infected computers damaged some centrifuges. They thought that the trick would destroy Iran's nuclear industry, at least in Natanz, but they were wrong.
Between 2007 and 2012, several assassination attempts were made, leaving four nuclear scientists dead. Those were Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, and Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, while another scientist, Fereydoun Abbasi, was wounded in an attempted murder in 2010 but survived.
They think that they can advance their agenda by assassinating people, which is partly true. After a scientist is assassinated, you'll need to wait for 30 years to have someone like him trained, if at all. This is a cause for concern. But on the other hand, this made people more resolute to continue their work with more rigor. Our distinctive attitude, which I call the spirit of self-sacrifice, has enabled us to do that. When such incidents take place, we'll become more courageous to try harder. This led to an increase in the number of young people who choose to study and start work in this field.
The one thing that curbed Iran's nuclear program was diplomacy and convention, meaning the 2015 JCPOA or nuclear deal signed between Iran and the P5 plus one countries, which include the US. But Iran's commitment to that deal was returned by US deal breaking. Talking of the importance of education to the livelihood of the nuclear program, universities are closely connected to nuclear research centers. In 1959, soon after the launch of the Iranian nuclear program, the Tehran Nuclear Research Center, TNRC, was established as part of Tehran University. And in 2007, the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, NSTRI, was established to meet the country's demand for the development of nuclear science and technologies. NSTRI is affiliated to Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. Examples for nuclear education and educational centers are many, but what's marvelous is 1,300 students switching majors to nuclear sciences in 2012 to fill in for an assassinated scientist, Ahmadi Roshan. More than 1,500 sanctions were imposed on Iran after Trump's USA withdrew from the nuclear deal or agreement, many of those sanctions being related to Iran's nuclear activities. It is now to be seen whether this country's nuclear upgrading by research and membership will serve as the deterrent and incentive intended to get those sanctions lifted with the November Vienna talks. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week for a follow-up or a totally different story. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, warned the Muslims from having the following qualities. He, peace be upon him, said, "Bad is captivity after victory, depression after the misfortune, rudeness with the poor, cruelty with the neighbor, miserliness towards the relative, disagreement with the friend, misbehavior towards the family, impudence through the power, greediness during poverty, backbiting the friend, telling lies, the slander, perfidy from the ruler, the rage from the generous. Whoever asks more than his right is worth of deprivation. Setting right the one who does not know dignity is through disgracing him. The careful one rises in rank. The cautious one finds good."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So when we're talking about the different conversations and the dialogues of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, we find in one specific conversation with his companion that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked about the people who are against the Ahlul Bayt, the people who are against and opposed to the family of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, and the people who are against the infallible imams, the divinely appointed imams, the divinely appointed successors of the Holy Prophet. In response to this statement and this question by the companion, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says that the tribulation of the people against us is burdensome. And so here he's talking about the calamities, the tragedies, the punishment, divine punishment that befalls the people who are against the Ahlul Bayt is certainly something which is heavy and dire and severe. And then to follow up Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says, when we ask them to follow us, they do not respond to us. Meaning these people who are opposed to the infallible imams, these people who are against the infallible imams, these people who are the enemies of the infallible imams, when they are asked to follow the Ahlul Bayt and the family of the Holy Prophet and the infallible imams, they do not respond. They ignore the qualities. These are, my friends, of those who are against the Ahlul Bayt. Tribulations and calamities befall them, and they ignore the statements of the Ahlul Bayt. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. What we're suggesting is that as a community of believers out here, we've got to move towards the process of purifying our understanding. The words of the imams are pure themselves. Our knowledge of the sayings of the imam is not pure. We don't purely have the knowledge of the sayings of the imam. There's a lot of other statements, misinterpretations, mistranslations that we have in our mind as the words of the Ma'sumin. We've got to filter that out, and we've got to use the methodology that the Ahlul Bayt presented. Imam al-Baqir presented the part of it that we can start with and inshallah progress and move forward with, get to more details, and everyone can move towards this notion that hadith books are strictly for the ulama is not correct. Imam al-Sadiq mentioned a lot of what he mentioned in an audience of average people. It's recorded in a book. Why is that hadith restricted for ulama? It's not. Books of hadith should be books that everyone goes. It's nur. The majority, 90%+ of our hadith are reliable. Go and read those hadith yourselves. We should get to that point. We should learn the Arabic language. We should have translations. It's important for those who can engage in translating these with utmost care, of course. Utmost care, to the best of our ability. And anything beyond our ability is not our taklif. If I can't understand any more than this, this is what I understand. This is the best translation I can offer. I did my best. But this is not the word of the imam. This is my understanding. I'm presenting it. It's better than not presenting it.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
In a New York City borough where residents have long struggled to afford their homes, thousands of people are now threatened with eviction as state pandemic aid dwindles. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Mir Zaveri, Matthew Haag, and Sophia Cerda Campero. The piece is titled, How the Pandemic Worsened the Housing Crisis in the Bronx. Stay with us for more of the New York Times article. Olivia Fernandez used to commute every day from her one-bedroom apartment in the Bronx in New York City to an Ecuadorian restaurant in Queens, where she worked as a cook and earned $700 a week. But when the pandemic hit New York City last year, the restaurant shut down and she lost her job. Ms. Fernandez got COVID-19 in March of 2020, and ever since she has felt weak and unable to work. Her two young daughters were also infected. For 20 months, Livia Fernandez has not paid her $1,400 rent. She owes more than $28,000. Her landlord has yet to demand payment, instead hoping that Ms. Fernandez would qualify for a state pandemic relief program. But with the rent relief program now nearly out of money, Ms. Fernandez knows her housing situation is precarious. Where will I go with two daughters? Ms. Fernandez says, I can't live in the streets. The pandemic has left millions of people across the country jobless and on the brink of losing their homes. But few places better illustrate the escalating housing crisis than the Bronx neighborhood of New York City, where working-class residents have long struggled to afford the city's rising cost of living. Before the pandemic, more than one-third of households in the Bronx spent at least half of their income on rent. More than 26,000 renters in the borough have been sued by their landlord since the pandemic began, the highest concentration of eviction cases in New York State, and more than in many large American cities, including Philadelphia, St. Louis, Cincinnati, according to the Eviction Laboratory at Princeton University. A state moratorium on evictions, one of the strongest in the nation, has helped keep the number of cases from being even higher. They are far below pre-pandemic levels. While many lawsuits do not lead to actual evictions, the mere filing of a case can land a renter on a so-called tenant blacklist, making it much more difficult to find and qualify for another apartment. Still, many residents, like Livia Fernandez, remain out of work and unable to pay their rent. The 12.4% unemployment rate in the Bronx neighborhood in September was almost triple the national figure. More than $248 million in pandemic rent relief has been distributed in the borough of Bronx, according to the most recent data, more than in the entire states of Indiana, Arizona, and Connecticut combined. The state has been so overwhelmed with requests for aid that it has stopped accepting new applications and says that more than 70,000 pending applications could be left in limbo.